Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Tensions have been high in Ukraine this week after Russia attacked Ukrainian ships in the Kerch Strait and seized several vessels, taking over 20 Ukrainian sailors prisoner, and Ukraine has declared martial law as a result. To help understand what happened and what this means, Marta Dychok spoke to a military expert and a political scientist. Our feature interview this week is with Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, former commander of U.S. forces in Europe, now analyst in Washington's think tank SEPA, and University of Toronto's Professor Lucan Wei. But first, the news. On martial law. Well, Ukraine has declared martial law after Russia seized three of its naval vessels off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula last Sunday. The measure will last 30 days and only impact regions along the Ukrainian-Russian border, a section of the Ukrainian-Moldovan border, and the coasts of the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. Ukraine has also banned entry to all male Russian nationals aged 16 to 60. Escalation started when two Ukrainian gunboats and a tugboat tried to pass through the Kerch Strait on Sunday, and the Russians intercepted the vessels and rammed the tugboat. Several Ukrainian crew members were reportedly injured when fire was opened against the vessels. All crew members were arrested by Russia. Trump versus Putin. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump canceled a planned meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the G20 meeting in Argentina because Moscow had not released the Ukrainian vessels and sailors that it had seized. Foreign ministers of the G7, meanwhile, of the G7 countries, have expressed, quote, utmost concern, unquote, and called on Russia to release the ships and their crews. Several senior European politicians have also raised the possibility of new sanctions against Russia to punish it for capturing the three vessels at sea, an incident that many in the West fear could ignite a wider conflict. Yevhen Marchuk, who has represented Ukraine in a security subgroup of the Minsk Agreement since 2015, has become the head of the Ukrainian delegation. He held his first meeting on the 22nd of November as head. He was appointed by President Petro Poroshenko, who also invited him to join the security subgroup in 2015. And Ukraine's Ostschadbank has been awarded $1.3 billion by an international arbitration court in respect of the bank's claims against Russia to compensate for loss of business and assets in Crimea following Moscow's annexation of the peninsula in 2014. Quote, the amount of compensation will be $1.3 billion plus interest, unquote, Ostschadbank said in a statement, adding it would seek to enforce the ruling immediately in jurisdiction around the world. But Russian news agency Interfax cited a statement from Russia's justice ministry saying it did not recognize the ruling and did not believe the court had jurisdiction. Privatbank against former owners. Ukraine's Privatbank would appeal a London court's conclusion that the court does not have jurisdiction over a case pitting Privatbank against its former owners. In a statement, Privatbank also said the court judgment had not been handed down in its final form yet and that the judge had found the bank had been the victim of a massive fraud.
On Sunday, the 25th of November, 2018, Ukraine hit the international headlines again. Media began reporting that there had been a, quote, confrontation between Russian and Ukrainian forces in the Kerch Strait. That's a small passageway between the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. And also that Ukraine was preparing to introduce martial law in response. To help us understand what happened and what the implications, we have two experts with us today. Lieutenant General Ben Hodges is a retired United States Army officer who served as the commanding general of the United States Army in Europe. He is now the parishing chair in strategic studies at the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington. We reached him in Berlin, where he's attending the Berlin Security Conference. Professor Lucan Wei teaches political science at the University of Toronto. He's an expert on Ukraine and the co-director of the Petro Yatsik Program for the Study of Contemporary Ukraine. We reached him in Toronto. Gentlemen, thank you very much for finding the time to speak to us. I'd like to start with what happened and the military international side of things, and then move on to the Ukrainian response. So, Lieutenant General Hodges, let's start with you. We live in an age of information warfare, deliberate disinformation. Russia has accused Ukraine of provoking an incident. Three Ukrainian ships were attacked by Russian vessels. 23 Ukrainian soldiers were taken prisoner, sailors were taken prisoner. As a retired U.S. Army commander, a military expert analyst, is there any question in your mind about what happened in the Kerch Strait on Sunday? And what is your assessment of the situation?
Well, Marcia, first, this is entirely predictable. This is classic Russian use of lawfare to try and twist interpretations of international law. The entire world agreed that their annexation of Crimea was illegal. And now to claim that Ukrainian naval vessels violated Russian territorial waters around Crimea is classic. And if the world sort of stands by and somehow gives some sort of equivalency to what Russia has done to what Ukraine has done, then that in effect adds credibility to Russia's claim of Crimea as being sovereign Russian territory and therefore Russian territorial waters. So that's why it's so important that the West, the international community, really needs to be very loud and very clear that this was not a violation of Russian territorial waters, because Russia's claim to Crimea is completely false and illegal. Everybody has seen the video. This is obviously a deliberate effort by Russian forces to keep pushing the line, if you will, to find out how far they can go until the West says, okay, stop, that's enough. And then they'll pull back, and then they'll keep pushing again a little bit further, a little bit further to change the facts on the ground, or in this case, change the facts on the sea. The bridge, a brand new lieutenant could recognize immediately that when they built this bridge, this was going to be a gate across the Kerch Straits. And the activity of the Russian Navy over the past few months, interfering with shipping, interfering with the Ukrainian Navy, all violations of international law and of their own agreement with Ukraine. So nobody should be surprised by this.
You mentioned the video of the Russian ship ramming the Ukrainian ship, which has been widely circulated. I've been wondering, how did the Ukrainian security service get a hold of that? I mean, as a military person, do you have any insight how that sort of thing can happen? Because that really is the visual evidence.
What's amazing is we have been getting information about Russian operations in the Donbass and in Crimea and in other places for the last few years.
Sorry to interrupt. We is the United States, or?
I'm sorry. Well, the international community,
right?
Because of social media. I mean, Russian soldiers, Russian sailors frequently post on social media pictures of themselves as their unit moves across into the Donbass, for example, or other places. And when you are smart about looking at social media, you're able to figure out what's going on despite official government denials. There's irrefutable evidence of Russian troops, for example, being in Syria or in the Donbass or in Crimea. So I'm not surprised, actually, that some video that might have been taken from a Russian ship would end
clearly
up,
it's from a Russian ship
on YouTube. Yeah, of course. So I'm not surprised that this would end up in the social media spaces, because they have a habit of indiscipline, if you will, of these kind of things getting out. So it doesn't surprise me that that would be out there somehow.
It's interesting. We were speaking with my students about the impact of social media, so I'll have to use that as an example next time. Something else that has recently shown up is videos of these captured Ukrainian sailors who are allegedly confessing to breaking Russian orders or something. What's your take on that, and what can Ukraine do to secure the release of its sailors?
Well, first of all, again, the laughability of so-called Russian justice. I mean, this had to be one of the quickest trials in history, where in less than about 24 hours, all these sailors were sentenced to 2 months confinement. It's the whole thing is a farce, and nobody in the West should give any credence to anything that comes out of the Kremlin on this. The entire West should be very loud, very clear that this is unacceptable, and that those sailors should be returned, along with the Ukrainian naval vessels, should be returned immediately to Ukraine. I'm proud that our ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Ambassador Haley, has been very loud and clear. I'm disappointed that our president has not been nearly as loud and clear about this. But the West has got to be loud and clear and stick together on condemning what Russia has done. But we also, it's time to make sure that the alliance has a strong strategy for the Black Sea region. I mean, what's happening in Ukraine is just a symptom of what Russia is doing and to try and dominate the Black Sea as their own, because they need it as a launching pad into Syria, into the Eastern Mediterranean. Their influence, just like the 20% of Georgia that they still occupy 10 years after they said they would leave. So NATO has got to develop a strong, clear strategy that builds coherence of deterrence while still respecting the constraints of the Montreux Convention, which limits the number of non-Black Sea littoral ships that can be there.
Well, that actually takes me to my next question, the larger implications of what's happening. There were some discussions that this might be an escalation of Russian aggression in that sphere. There were very strong statements both at the United Nations and from NATO headquarters. But what, in fact, is likely to be the international response beyond just statements? What do you see NATO actually doing?
Well, the alliance, yeah. I think Romania is going to have to play a very important role here. Turkey, which is a good, strong, reliable NATO ally, is completely focused to their south with Syria and the various counterterrorism operations they're dealing with, plus more than 3 million refugees, and their maritime orientation is to the south as well, and into the Mediterranean. So, and because they don't have many naval, much infrastructure on the Black Sea, they've got to, they're not going to be much help in the Black Sea. And they do not want to rock the boat, if you will, pardon the pun, with Russia in the Black Sea region. So Romania is going to have to take on the load here.
Well, you are a U.S. retired general, so I was wondering what the U.S. perspective would be. But if I could just perhaps ask your advice, if you were advisor to Ukraine's President Poroshenko, what would you be advising him to do militarily? Because Ukraine continually asks for support from the international community, and they get a lot of verbal support. But what would you be advising him as a strategy? And this will be a lead into our discussion about what Ukraine has done. But militarily, what would you be advising?
Well, first of all, the international community, I would tell him to be loud and clear about and transparent on everything that's happening. He's got to make sure that people in the West do not fall victim and start believing the Russian narrative that somehow this whole incident was provoked was by the Ukrainians, and that this is all about upcoming elections. I mean, the Russians wasted no time in trying to generate that narrative. So President Poroshenko has got to work hard to make sure that serious people in the West do not subscribe to that or fall victim to it. That's number one. Number two, The Ukrainians have got to develop a maritime strategy. They don't have one because, you know, the Black Sea Fleet was always the Soviet. That's correct. The Soviet fleet, that known as the Black Sea Fleet, of course, at the end of the Cold War, the Ukrainians did not develop a, in my view, did not develop a Black Sea strategy. The naval headquarters remained at Odessa, so there's no Navy influence into strategy and policy making back in Kyiv. And so, and then, of course, when Russia seized Crimea, most of Ukraine's Navy was also lost, the core of the Navy, if you will. So they're basically starting from zero, having to reestablish what is their strategy, what do they need to do to protect their littoral, what do they need to do to ensure freedom of navigation, both in Sea of Azov, but also out in the Black Sea.
Well, it seems like in the middle of a crisis, developing a strategy is a little bit too late. The response that the Ukrainian president—
it's not going away. That's a fair point, but this is not going away. I mean, you've got to, just the way they had to change their land forces because of Donbass, you know, they've got to modernize and adjust their strategy for the maritime as well.
Well, perhaps this is where there's room for cooperation with international partners. But I'd like to bring in Professor Wei into this discussion. The response that came from Kyiv to this crisis in the Black Sea, Azov Sea area was to discuss martial law, which caused a lot of raised eyebrows. And I'm just wondering, Professor Wei, what is your take on this? Is this, why would somebody discuss martial law when you've been attacked on the sea? I mean, how do you make sense of that? And Ben, if you want to jump in on that, but let's start with Lucan.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to, you know, reiterate Ben's point that, you know, this represents a dangerous and illegal aggression on the part of Russia and really demands an international response, and obviously a very clear response by Ukraine. I have to say, though, that I was puzzled by President Poroshenko's decision to declare martial law. I mean, it seems like parts of the first of all, this is the first time since Ukraine became independent that martial law has been declared. Martial law was not declared even at the start of the crisis in 2014, which in many ways represented an even more dangerous situation for Ukrainian sovereignty when Russia was invading its territory. And neither acting President Turchinov nor Petro Poroshenko, who's president of when he began his presidency in 2014, declared martial law. So it's a little bit puzzling as to why he declares it now. I mean, parts of the martial law do relate to the military conflict. They call on sort of the mobilization of military resources in 10 provinces on the border region with Russia. At the same time, other parts which limit constitutional freedoms of assembly and free speech really seem to have not a clear at all relationship to the military crisis at all. And so, I mean, I agree with Ben that it's important not to see this simply as about upcoming elections, but in a sense, Petro Poroshenko makes it very hard not to see it as about upcoming elections. So I'd like his help on here. I mean, it's not simply Russian propaganda. He's sort of in some ways shooting himself in the foot, in my view, and sort of helping out and sort of feeding into Russian propaganda. It's interesting that at the same time, so first Poroshenko proposed a 60-day term of the martial law, which because the election campaign officially begins on December 31st, would have required a delay in the election, a change, and so that would have postponed the election. I have to say, Ukrainian society responded quite admirably. You really had a I wouldn't say a unanimous response, but you had a number of civil society and ex-government actors responding quite negatively to this expressed desire to have, you know, to delay the elections. I mean, including the three of the former presidents, Kravchuk, Kuchma, and Yushchenko, came out with a very powerful statement criticizing Poroshenko on this.
So what does this suggest about sort of domestic Ukrainian politics?
Well, I think it suggests, good things. I think, clearly suggests that Ukraine is not Russia. You know, this is a country in which the power of the president is not unlimited, and there are real checks. And, it also suggests that, Poroshenko must rely on the support of his, even of his opponents in the legislature. I think they forced some compromise. I think, for the two main sources of compromise was the fact that initially Poroshenko wanted martial law across the entire territory of Ukraine. Poroshenko agreed to only 10 of the provinces as opposed to the entire. And also he agreed to an initially term of 30 days as opposed to 60 days. And right now, as it stated, that martial law is supposed to end just a couple days before the official start of the campaign. So, it seems like it won't affect the electoral process. Although I want to sort of say a couple things about this. That first, martial law could be extended. And so we don't know yet. If that will happen or not. Hopefully it won't.
Well, I share your puzzlement about why a domestic policy of martial law is introduced in response to a foreign aggression or escalation of aggressions. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about what exactly will this martial law entail. You mentioned there's something, a military dimension. Ben, I don't know if you want to jump in here, but usually martial law is the way of limiting domestic civil liberties, right? So what exactly is likely to happen here? I don't know who wants to go first.
It's useful that the president.
That's Ben.
It's useful that the president has said this is for 30 days, mm-hmm. and it's also restricted to. This is not all across Ukraine, but to specific areas bordering the Donbass and also Transnistria. Mm-hmm. So that kind of very specific, limited scope in terms of location and time helps mitigate the narrative, the Russian narrative that this is, and also his own political opponents, that this is about the election. So that's important, and that needs to be understood. What it would do, of course, is would enable them to put people to work on defensive measures. This is a tradition, I think, from this part of the world, of putting people to work to help with preparation for defense. I think they do anticipate that this might possibly lead to something else. So the fact that the Rada had such a large vote in favor of it says something. I spoke to a very senior member of the Rada two nights ago, and they were concerned. They weren't sure what to do. They said, you know what, we didn't do this for the last 4.5 years. Why now? And those were fair questions. But at the end, you had a very large majority of the Rada voted in favor of it. And so I think the professor is correct in saying that, this is this highlights the difference between Ukraine as a democracy, which may be kind of messy, but nonetheless, compared to what you might find from in Russia.
So there is a potential defensive dimension to this. This is the part that I don't understand.
In the decree that was passed by Parliament, there is, it does indicate that military resources should be well funded and stocked, and that the region should prepare militarily for conflict, which is perfectly reasonable given the situation. At the same time, it does suggest that certain constitutional rights, free speech, freedom of assembly,
may be limited. That's right.
And I I'm glad it's 30 days, but I frankly fail to understand how that relates at all to the conflict. And it just kind of feeds into Russian narrative. I mean, it's a kind of it's his own fault. If Poroshenko had not done this, you wouldn't have me on the program, and you'd just be talking about the awful things that Russia's done, which would be better for everyone.
Well, so let me pose the question to both of you. If you were advising Poroshenko, what should he be doing in terms of strategy to deal with this situation? I mean, the martial law, let's put that aside, but what would be a good response, an adequate response?
So I think we need to kind of rethink Ukraine needs to rethink the notion of what's national security. I think one idea of national security in the context of the war has been, you know, rightly to limit Russian interference and limit Russian influence. But I think another aspect has to be strengthening the support and hearts and minds of the Russophone population in the southeast of Ukraine. And I think part of that, what I worry about the martial law is that it works against that. That that's just simply going to create more resentment in that population, which is so important because, you know, as we saw in 2014, you know, Putin wanted to go to all, you know, a good chunk of Ukraine. He wasn't able to because the population did not support him.
That's right.
And so,
that's right.
And why do things to antagonize that population is simply beyond me. I don't understand.
I share your bewilderment. Ben, did you want to come in on this?
Well,
I mean, as an advisor, would your advice be?
My advice is for they need to continue to think long term. That's why I mentioned earlier they mm-hmm. need a maritime strategy.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to make sure that their military is well equipped. Continue to focus on training and force generation. That pressure from Russia is not going to end as long as the Russians see profit in what they're doing to Ukraine. And so, at relatively low cost, Russia is undermining the Ukrainian government and sapping the morale. And so I think it's important to have a long-term view and continue to invest and get the country mobilized. You know, I go to Ukraine frequently, and if you're in Kyiv or Lviv, the two places I tend to go to, it doesn't really feel like they're at war.
It doesn't
and
at
so,
all. You should go to the war zone.
Yeah. I have been there also.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a... You're mobilizing your country. I think one of the things that they've got to do to make sure that they continue to gain support from the West is transparency with the defense spending, with their military budget. There is no transparency there. The RADA, the parliament, has no true visibility or oversight over where the money goes.
That's
and,
a problem.
I think this... This is something that would help build and retain support from the West is more transparency in government. Now, the Russians exploit this.
Yes.
They take advantage of the fact that you've got oligarchs in Ukraine that are as corrupt as any that you would find
anywhere
in Russia. And as long as that condition exists, then the Russians are going to exploit that as a weakness. So this is not just about getting more javelins or artillery ammunition. This is about a whole of government response and building up public support and resilience in the population, because this is going to go on. This is an extended conflict that Ukraine has got to settle in for.
What are your views on international engagement beyond advice and supplying weapons?
So, if I,
as you know, there are hundreds of American and Canadian soldiers that are at the training center in Yavoriv
mm-hmm.
already,
mm-hmm.
Along with the British, Lithuanian, and Polish that are helping to train Ukrainian units and help them get ready to go into the Donbass. The United States has provided hundreds of millions of dollars of supplies and equipment. Other nations like Canada have helped in a big way in terms of military medicine, as well as training and support. I think that, you know, there often is talk about an international peacekeeping force for
mm-hmm.
the Donbass, but I think that has no hope until you've got a peace to keep. And I have zero trust or confidence in the Russians that they would ever allow something like that to happen. They don't allow the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation, Special Monitoring Mission, to do their job.
Right.
So there's no way the Russians or the separatists, whom they command, by the way, would allow a peacekeeping force worthy of the name to actually do its mission. And so until the conditions are right, it's kind of hard to imagine a successful intervention or peacekeeping force, something like what we saw, the implementation force of the Dayton Peace Accords back in 1995-96. So the key for me is the international community, specifically the West, putting pressure on Russia. I don't know how Germany can continue with Nord Stream 2 while Russia does what it's doing. I mean, Germany is the key for the Minsk Agreement. Germany is the key for keeping the sanctions in place, but somehow they're continuing with Nord Stream 2. These things are all connected in the eyes of the Russians. And so, yeah.
No, that was very interesting commentary. I keep sort of visualizing the footage of the Russian ship ramming the Ukrainian ship and thinking this is sort of a visual depiction of the conflict, right? Like it's a little ship right. in bad shape with a very powerful modern ship. And that's, as you said, it's going to continue. Luke, and you wanted to come in on something.
Yeah, no, I just want to say that that I think, you know, certainly military support and, you know, financial support for Ukraine is very important, and obviously pressure on Russia. But I do think that the West, United States, Canada, and the like, have to be willing to criticize, problems with democracy in Ukraine. I think it's sort of a difficult situation for the West because I think primarily the West needs to support Ukraine against its war with Russia. But I think we also need to sort of have, be it private, maybe it's already going on. I don't know. I'm not privy to these things. But I think, needs maybe in private, but sort of real sort of pressure on Ukrainian government to sort of limit its violations of democratic practice. For one thing, the West, in terms of actual impact, can really have an impact on Ukraine in a way that it will never have an impact on Russia. So I think that's also important.
Thank you both. Transparency, communication with society, long-term strategies. This is the advice that we've received from Professor Luke Nwei and Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. Thank you very much for speaking to us. Hope to have you on the show again.
Thanks.
Thanks very much. Enjoy it.
And moving on to music. With war heating up, here's a song about the current war that has ancient roots. It's by a band from Odessa called Druzhe Muziko. They wrote it in 2015 when the first wounded soldiers began arriving in hospitals in their city. These musicians said they couldn't just stand by and do nothing, so they found an ancient prayer that Cossacks used before going into battle in the 17th century and gave it a modern ethno-drive spin. Some of the words of the prayer are recited, included, "We're not afraid of fire or cold, we're defending."
Пресвята Богородиця, Мати Христова, укрий ризою своєю святою від неба до землі мене самого, коня мого, і хто при мені є. Дня на день.
Next week, we'll be back with another Ukraine Calling program for Hromadske Radio. We invite you to join us. If you would like to comment or have ideas to share with us, do write to us at our email address. And this is Bohdan Nahailo in Kyiv for Hromadske Radio signing off. Thank you so much for listening.